This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, the weekend edition of Family Research Council's Washington Watch.
Hello and welcome to the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm your host, David Salkeld, a constitutional conservative, husband, and homeschool dad. Well, the election process, which seems to have lasted almost 2 years, is finally over. On Tuesday, America selected our first ever president that had no prior political experience and no prior military service. And so far, liberals in our country have not taken too kindly to President-elect Donald Trump's victory. Now, a little later in the show, filmmaker Dinesh D'Souza will join Tony with his analysis of why the left is reacting the way that they are. But first, most polls and pundits predicted that Hillary Clinton would win the race to the White House, and by a landslide. So when Donald Trump won, it stunned political experts and the media. All but one, Dr. Helmut Norpoth, a political science professor at Stony Brook University in New York State, and author of The Primary Model. And that model has been right in each of the past five presidential elections. Dr. Norpoth joined Tony on Thursday with his analysis.
Dr. Norpoth, welcome to Washington Watch.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your show.
All right. Don't keep me in suspense. How is it that you've developed a model that works and runs counter to what the pollsters are saying?
Well, it doesn't use polling, so that's the one thing. I don't ask people how they plan to vote. I examine how people actually voted in real elections, the general elections over about 200 years and presidential primaries over the last 100 years. And I have found that the presidential primaries are a very uncanny leading indicator of what is happening in the November election. I also find that there's something like a swing of the pendulum in presidential elections that was poised to swing to the Republican side in 2016, even without Trump. So the two things together enabled me to make this forecast that I stated that Trump would have a very high probability of being elected president.
So you're saying that human behavior, well, let me narrow that, the American voter's behavior is somewhat predictable.
Absolutely. It's very difficult over the phone, but I have a chart that tracks sunspots over about a 200-year period, and if you overlay it with presidential election, now that might sound rather foolish, you will see that both behave in a rather similar fashion, and that whatever you can apply to the sunspots, to a natural phenomenon, might also apply to elections.
So even with the almost polar opposite personalities that we saw in this election, you're saying that you could almost put the personalities aside and predict the outcome of the election?
Well, not quite, because the primaries, where the candidates have to show how strong they are, tells us something about their sort of personal appeal. And when you look at how somebody like Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump do in early primaries like New Hampshire and South Carolina, you can learn a lot about their strength as candidates. And I think it was very telling that that Hillary Clinton lost the first primary to Bernie Sanders. Then she came back and beat him in South Carolina, but that was a split verdict. And I think it told us something about her difficulties of being a successful candidate in the end, compared to Donald Trump, who won both of these primaries against a very far-ranging field that he had to contend with.
Now, what if it would have been one of the other candidates in the runoff? Now, you had Ted Cruz went all the way up to the end, almost captured the nomination, but fell just a bit short. Donald Trump then captures the nomination. Did you run models to see if someone else would have captured the nomination, how it would have turned out?
Well, I can certainly make some predictions based on other candidates, how they performed in the critical contest that I examined in New Hampshire and South Carolina. So I had matchups for almost any conceivable pairing of candidates, Republican and Democratic, based on how they did in those two primaries.
Did any candidate do better against Hillary Clinton than your your model with Donald Trump head-to-head with Hillary?
You mean it? Well, because Donald Trump was the strongest Republican, any other Republican would have done worse.
Interesting. You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Dr. Helmut Norpoth, my guest, we're talking about, he has developed a statistical model that doesn't use surveys, which I think in this election, and I want to ask you about this, Dr. Norpoth, when people are becoming more, they're lumping the pollsters, those who take these surveys, kind of in with the media, and there's this growing hostility toward the media, so there's a less likelihood that they're going to be forthright with him. Is this type of modeling take that out so that you can get a better read?
Well, I don't have to contend with the problem of finding out what people are thinking that the pollsters have or what kind of people are turning out to vote. So I don't have to worry about this because I only take what actually happens when people go to the polls and vote. So the people who do that, they tell me something. The people who don't vote, well, they don't tell me anything. But if they don't vote in November, then they will not be part of the game anyway.
Now, were you able, based on your model, what turnout levels did you base that on, or were you able to basically project the turnout we had in the general election based upon past performance and behavior?
That's a very difficult thing. I think the turnout is something that I've not tried that. I don't know what the answer would be, but I don't make any assumptions about turnout, how many people are turning out in the general. I just make a statement about how the people who are turning out, how they are breaking, and that's I don't really have anything to say about the turnout per se.
Well, that could alter, I would think, your model.
Sure.
If you have a higher turnout than what's projected, and in this case, the turnout, we're still looking at the numbers, but appears to be slightly higher than the last election overall. And it certainly looks as if certain segments, like evangelicals, broke more strongly for Donald Trump than they had in past elections. So those things certainly factor in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't even
know what the overall turnout is. I actually, from what I've seen in terms of the overall numbers, I actually would expect turnout is down even compared to 4 years ago.
Yeah, I think in the presidential, the numbers are down. I think in overall, there's slightly uptick in overall participation. So some people did not vote top of the ticket. Where do you see us politically as a nation? Are you seeing, in your modeling, does it show a more divided and politically polarized nation?
Well, I don't see any movement away from polarization. I think that this is a very split down the middle election. I think in terms of the popular vote, it's almost like exactly a 50-50. If you look at some of the breakdowns about how Democrats and Republicans voted, it's a very high degree of sticking with the ticket, very little defection, very, very, very small. So, of course, you have independents who are not attached, and they're about a third of the electorate. I would say the polarization was probably pretty much what we have seen in the last few elections. I don't see any shift away from that.
One final question for you, Dr. Norpoth. Any of these polling organizations talking to you about trying to use your model for future projections?
No, I have not gotten any calls from any pollster. I've gotten a lot of calls from people like you and radio shows and television and newspapers, and they ask me about this. No, that's not from any poll. I mean, I know some of the polls. I know some of the people who do this polling aggregation, and I've been together with some of them, and we've had some discussions about what's going on. But I think they will just try to find better ways of getting people to respond and trying to figure out, which is a big problem for them, who is actually going to turn out on election day. That's something they have to they have to do a better job at.
Well, that's extremely difficult. The whole ball game is the turnabout.
Yeah, but because if you don't do that, then you might not as well make a projection from polls, because you're saying something about actual voters. So if you don't want to say, I mean, Gallup actually did maybe the right thing, and after the 2012 election, which he got wrong, he picked Romney to beat Obama. Soon after that, he quit this business, which Gallup essentially invented 80 years ago.
Yeah, it's human behavior. I think you can predict it from a standpoint of past behavior. In fact, we talk about that with elected officials. We believe that's why we track their records, because we believe past performance is the best indicator of future performance. But when you're relying on questions in candid responses, especially as we become a more politically polarized culture, and there's a hostility seen in the media, when the media kind of takes sides, people simply want to avoid conflict. So I think they're going to avoid answering these questions, or they're going to answer them the way they think the pollster wants them to answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right, Pete. And the rate of people responding to polls is just abysmal. I mean, it's just very, very low. It's so low, I think, that it's very difficult to make a case that you're actually saying something about the larger electorate.
Right, because they always call during dinner anyway. So,
Dr.
Norpol, thank you so much for joining us. Very, very interesting. We'll be watching your website in future elections to see what you're projecting.
My pleasure.
All right. Thanks so much.
You can find out more about Dr. Helmut Norpoth when you visit tonyperkins.com. When we return, Dinesh D'Souza will be here. Don't go away. We'll be right back with more of the weekend edition of Washington Watch right after this.
We all know what it feels like. We try to avoid it. Experts define it as an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with actual or potential tissue damage, or describes in terms of such damage. What is it? It's pain. Did you realize that you probably started feeling pain at a very young age, or even before you were born? Scientific studies have increased our knowledge of life inside the womb. We now have strong evidence that unborn babies can feel pain by 20 weeks or earlier. At Family Research Council, we believe that all babies are worth protecting. We also hope that even those who don't share our pro-life commitment will listen to the medical community and support laws that protect the unborn child from cruel suffering. For more information, visit frc.org/fetal pain. That is frc.org/fetal pain.
Since September 11th, 2001, America has been at war. And that's about all anyone can say with certainty about a conflict that has cost 7,000 American lives and almost $2 trillion. As long as the most basic strategic questions, such as who is the enemy and what are we fighting, remain unanswered, victory is impossible. Yet this war is eminently winnable if we remove our ideological blinders and apply basic strategic principles. Our enemy is the global jihadi movement, a modern totalitarian ideology rooted in the doctrines and martial history of Islam. America has defeated totalitarian enemies before. Providing a desperately needed dose of clarity, counterterrorism expert Dr. Sebastian Gorka shows how we can do it again in a recent talk at FRC headquarters in Washington, D.C. Dr. Gorka's bracing, troubling, but ultimately encouraging lecture, entitled Defeating Jihad, the Winnable War, can be viewed at frc.org/war.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm your host, David Salkeld. Angry protests began to erupt across the country against President-elect Donald Trump on election night. Some not so peaceful. And they don't seem to be slowing down. These violent reactions beg the observation. Does the left really do everything that they rail against conservatives for? To help answer that, Dinesh D'Souza joined Tony on Thursday.
Dinesh, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hey, it's good to be on the show.
Hey, we were talking about what's happening there in New York, other major cities, how those that weren't happy with what happened Tuesday night, have taken to the streets, looting, burning flags, destroying private property. You know, and the left preaches tolerance. They preach that we should be accepting and all of these things. But when things don't go their way, they don't actually practice what they preach.
You know, I've been a little bit reluctant to condemn all these protests because, as you know, we've seen, of course, the horrible Romney riots and the McCain riots. Oh, wait. Sorry. There weren't any Romney riots, were there? And there weren't any McCain riots. So, you know, this is, I think you're right. I'm being facetious. I think the point to be made is that, in general, our side is far more decent about, we would have been super disappointed had Hillary won, but we would have accepted the outcome. These guys act as if there's some inherent right that they have to rule the country. And so this display of bad behavior shows that the intolerance is squarely on their side.
You know, I was talking about this earlier, and I don't have any problem with him not liking Donald Trump, not wanting to get in line behind him, because I'm going to tell you right now, I would not get in line behind Hillary Clinton. But just like I did not want to get behind and did not get behind Barack Obama in 2012 after his reelection, most pro-abortion, anti-faith, freedom president in the history of the country. But I didn't go out and start burning cars and tires. I went to work to try to affect the outcome of the next election. What is it about the left that they don't get?
Well, I think two things are going on here. One is the fact that the media has been putting out the message for now 3 months that not only is Trump a bad guy from their point of view, but is somehow an illegitimate candidate, that he doesn't have the right to even contest the presidency, that he's so outside the American mainstream. And Obama and Hillary have both fortified this idea that somehow he's not a normal Republican, he's beyond the pale, he's going to blow up the world, he's a bigot, and so on. So this is licensed, if you will, the violent left, to say, okay, well, acting on those instructions, we're going to sort of take it to the streets. I think the second is that it has now dawned on them the stakes involved. Not only has our side, if I can use that term, saved the Supreme Court, but there's now the prospect that we will, in a sense, dominate all three branches of government. And we haven't really had that in a very long time. The Democrats have been so used to being the majority party, going all the way back to the New Deal, till 1980. Since then, we've had a sort of divided government. But now, for the first time, the path clears for Republicans to have the Congress and the presidency, and if Trump gets a couple of nominees, the court. And so the left is going ballistic.
And it's even bigger than that, Dinesh. If you look at the and that's big. I mean, that's like Barney Fife said, that's bigger than the gold truck when it was coming through Mayberry. But when you look at the bench on the left, the Democratic bench, it's non-existent. You had two people running, basically, in the Democratic primary. You had Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. And Tim Kaine, you know, he's not got a future running for anything. Where are they going to find their leaders? And you compare that to the Republicans that had 17 people running for president, governors, they picked up two more governorships. And I mean, the bench is deep on the Republican side. They could, if they do it right, could dominate American politics for a generation.
That's a good point. I don't think the left is wise enough to be thinking that far ahead. I think what they're looking at is the fact that they've had this sort of free run with Obama. They were looking to continue it with Hillary. They felt sure with the polls and with the experts. They thought they had this. They were literally uncorking the champagne. And so part of this is the great gap between being sure you're going to win and facing the certainty that you've lost. That's just a wide road to travel, a big swing of the pendulum, and emotionally they're proving incapable of handling it.
But where do they go from here? I mean, do they keep these tantrums up for 4 years?
Well, I think what they're trying to do is put the Republican administration in some senses beyond the pale. I think, in other words, what they want to do, I think, is to provoke Trump. They're going to try to sort of disrupt things enough to create a taint of illegitimacy around anything that is done by the new administration. This is why I think it's really important for Trump to respond to this in a calm, statesmanlike manner. It's important for us not to freak out on our side. and just recognize that this is just juvenile tantrums by people who don't accept the results of an election. Now, we'll see what they do. I mean, ultimately, if they try to secede from the union or try to do stuff like that, then we'll have to consider those things when the time is right. But as of now, what you're basically getting is essentially, you know, people who haven't grown up responding in a kind of childish way to a result that they don't like.
Well, let me ask you about that, because I think you're right. I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to taint the Trump administration, try to make them radioactive. But in a way, that's what they did in the election, in the campaign, and it didn't work. He went straight, unlike most politicians who try to pacify the media, placate them, and avoid confronting them. I mean, he went right at them, went right at the left. I don't think... You know, and I think that's what motivated people to support him in the large numbers that he did. So I'm not sure that's going to work.
Yeah, he pulled a surprise move on them. He went behind their flank and stole voters that they didn't think were even at risk. As you know, Hillary didn't even bother to go to Wisconsin. She thought that that state was so safe in her camp. So, yeah, I think that, you know, this was a case where the left felt that they couldn't lose. And part of the reason they felt they couldn't lose is there was a revolt inside the Republican Party. It almost looked like the party that is smaller, that has, if you will, 40% or 45% of the electorate, somehow had one-third of its own members who were defecting away from Trump, and some of them even openly for Hillary. I mean, you saw how President Bush and George H.W. Bush and Mitt Romney, so Trump seemed to be a weakened Republican who couldn't possibly pull it off, and yet, against all odds, with almost, you may say, providential supervision, he did.
Found it interesting. I know you've looked at these numbers, but the percentage of support that he gained from evangelical voters, despite the issues they had with his character and past behavior, they turned out and voted more for him than they did George W. Bush in 2004. That is pretty significant, and I would think is going to leave a mark on his administration.
Well, there are going to be some Christians who complain about that, but to me, it actually represents the political maturation of evangelical Christians. Because, look, you know, we know from experience that you can have a guy like George H.W. Bush, who was a war hero, as was Bob Dole. Reagan made war movies during World War II, and Reagan yet had the ability to show leadership and inspire the military in a way that Bush and Dole did not. And so the irony is that sometimes someone can be flawed in personal life and nevertheless have those leadership qualities. You know, clearly the last time around, the Republicans dominated a very clean-cut guy, Romney, and the time before, another very clean-cut guy, McCain. And yet the left was able to portray them as Lucifer. And so this time, I think Republicans said, look, we need a tough guy. Hillary and Bill play rough. We need someone who can throw a punch. Now, if he's an outsider, he might have a couple of skeletons in his closet, but he still might have that public leadership that will enable him to get to the White House, and they've been proven right.
But Dinesh, it was more than just picking somebody who was a street fighter, if you will, that could make their way to the White House. He also made some very clear, specific commitments, articulated positions of concern, or areas that are of concern to evangelicals, like the partial birth abortion. He embraced religious liberty. He really went further than most Republicans have gone in the past in building those bridges into the evangelical world, and it appears that it paid off big time for him.
Would you say, Tony, that you thought that Trump took a stronger, substantive pro-evangelical stance than, say, George W. Bush did?
I think he did when it came to the issue of abortion. If you'll notice, I was, you know, in that last debate, that third debate is where I think he actually sealed it. He closed the deal when he actually said, he said it before, but he, in that debate, said he would nominate pro-life justices. We didn't have, George Bush wouldn't say that. Other candidates wouldn't say that. Nominees wouldn't say that because they didn't want to have a litmus test. And then he also went directly at the issue of late-term abortion. We've not had a nominee that has done that before. And I believe that may be the most important moment in this campaign in terms of his support that he gained from evangelicals.
That's very interesting. I spoke at the Liberty University convocation a couple of weeks ago. Jerry Falwell, of course, had come out for Trump. But because of some of the revelations about Trump's personal life and the stuff on the bus, there was some Christian resistance to what Jerry Falwell Jr. had done. And so in the teeth of all that, I spoke at convocations of students and was able to have some very good dialogues with them about how in politics, you know, the world is flawed, the candidates we pick are flawed, and we're choosing between two existing candidates. It's always utopian to think that there's some third option that's not right. even on the table that can come in and save the day.
Yeah, In fact, I was there shortly after you were speaking at convocation, I think a week or so later, and the feedback was very positive from your interaction with the students. And I think that's a part of the problem. People step back who are not engaged in this process, and they try to create this ideal situation and say, well, you just have to, you know, we want this or we want that. Well, you have to deal with what you have. And in this election, we had two individuals who were, quite frankly, less than desirable if we would have been able to shape our own candidates. And most of us, now Jerry Jr.'s an exception, but most of us were not with Donald Trump in the beginning. But when it came down to a choice between him and Hillary, and those revelations came out. But I think as we got closer to the election, I think people took the approach that you discussed that with those students, that you have to make a choice based on what is before you.
I think the other thing, the other factor, and this was very much the theme of my movie, Hillary's America, and the accompanying book of the same title, was simply the fact that I think people realized that, you know, we normally choose between kind of the normal Republican, the normal Democrat. Well, Hillary isn't a normal Democrat. She's in many ways, she would have been worse even than Obama, because Obama, at the end of the day, is an ideologue. But the Clintons are sort of like Bonnie and Clyde. I mean, these are people who have taken corruption to an unprecedented level. And they've abused the White House before. They've certainly abused the office of Secretary of State. To put them in charge of the Treasury and give them the kind of power, which, by the way, is unchecked by the media. We've seen that in this right. election. It's a terrifying prospect. So I believe that this country, most people don't realize how narrowly we dodged a bullet.
I could not agree with you more.
To find out more about Dinesh D'Souza and his movie, Hillary's America, go to TonyPerkins.com. Also, while you're there, sign up for Tony's Washington Update. It's a daily email highlighting the important issues affecting your faith, family, and freedom. Well, that's it for this week's show. I'm David Salkel, thanking you for being with us, and I encourage you to be back here next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
The weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you've heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can help support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 866-372-7234.